Hello and welcome. This is Mark Weber. Thanks for being with me today. In this broadcast, I'll be taking a look at the plot to kill Hitler in 1944, at the daring conspiracy behind the assassination attempt, and at the legacy of the anti-Hitler circle and its place in history and meaning for us today. On the afternoon of Thursday, July 20th, 1944, a bomb suddenly exploded in the conference room at Hitler's wooded headquarters in East Prussia, the so-called Wolf's Lair. The terrific blast instantly killed one man and mortally wounded three others. Several other men were badly injured, and others suffered less severe injuries. But the man whom the assassins above all hoped to kill, Adolf Hitler, suffered only light burns and bruises, and later that same afternoon was able to meet and confer with the visiting Italian leader Mussolini as previously scheduled. The man who planted the bomb and who was the dynamic central personality of the anti-Hitler conspiracy was a 36-year-old German army officer, Klaus von Stauffenberg. He was born of an aristocratic Southwest German family, hence the von in his name. He was also a Graf, or Count. He had been a career military officer and had been promoted to colonel. While serving in North Africa, he had been severely injured in a British air attack. On that fateful July 20th, von Stauffenberg left a bomb in a briefcase in the conference room. A few minutes later, he left to return to Berlin, which was the conspirators' center of operations. As he was leaving the Wolf's Lair headquarters, the bomb exploded at precisely 12:42 in the afternoon. It instantly killed Heinrich Berger, a stenographer, and three others who were severely injured later died: Air Force General Günter Korten, Army General and Chief Adjutant of the Armed Forces to Hitler, Rudolf Schmutt, and Colonel Heinz Brandt. It's important to put this event into some time context. By this time, that is July 1944, the tide of war had turned decisively against Germany and in favor of the Allied powers, that is, above all, in favor of the military power of the Soviet Union and the United States. Already in 1943, Soviet troops had won major military victories in the battles of Stalingrad and Orel-Kursk, and in the first half of 1944 had driven German forces hundreds of miles westwards. The Soviets had reached the Baltic region and the border of Hungary. In the west, British and American forces had, just a few weeks earlier, made a successful D-Day landing in Normandy in northern France. In the south, British and American forces had pushed northwards in Italy, including capture of the capital city of Rome. In Germany itself, the major cities were under devastating aerial bombardment by British and American warplanes. As a reflection of the fundamental ideology of German society in the years since the defeat of World War II, von Stauffenberg and the other anti-Hitler conspirators are routinely honored. In every major German city, there's a street named in honor of von Stauffenberg. Every year in Germany, on the anniversary of the assassination attempt, public figures praise the July 20th conspirators and express their gratitude for, as they put it, giving for men who gave their lives to oppose Hitler and the Nazi regime. Americans may be most familiar with the July 1944 conspiracy and the attempt to kill Hitler through a major motion picture that was released in late 2008 titled Valkyrie, with Tom Cruise starring in the main role playing von Stauffenberg. In Germany today, as in the motion picture Valkyrie, von Stauffenberg and the anti-Hitler conspirators are portrayed as admirable men of honor, courage, conscience, and principle. Well, in this talk today, I'm going to look in more deeply at this image and some of the assumptions about this entire event. How accurate is this image of these men? Were the conspirators really admirable individuals? What was their ideology and outlook? How realistic was their plan? The 1944 assassination attempt is one of the great what-ifs of modern history. What's likely to have happened if the bomb left by von Stauffenberg had killed Hitler? And if the German leader had been killed in the blast, could the conspirators have succeeded in seizing power in Berlin? And if so, what would they have achieved after that? And what are the lessons of the anti-Hitler conspiracy and the assassination attempt? Well, first I'm going to take a look at the dramatic events of July 20th, 1944. At that time, von Stauffenberg was a chief of staff to General Friedrich Fromm, who was commander of the so-called Reserve Army or Replacement Army. It was in that position that the young Colonel Stauffenberg was assigned to give reports in person at Hitler's headquarters at his briefing conferences, and thereby giving him access personally to Hitler himself. Von Stauffenberg and the other men involved in the conspiracy resolved to make use of a special emergency plan, codenamed Valkyrie, that Hitler himself had approved. The Valkyrie plan envisioned that the Reserve Army or Replacement Army would take over in case of an enemy air landing in Berlin, or disorders by foreign workers in Berlin or other large cities, or if there was an attempted takeover coup or putsch, or any other significant large-scale unrest in Germany, especially in Berlin, the capital. The conspirators intended to make use of the Valkyrie plan to take over themselves through a military putsch or coup to seize control of the national government and the armed forces. Three retired men, they planned, would head the new regime. They envisioned that a retired General Erwin von Witzleben would be the new commander-in-chief of the armed forces. They planned that a retired general named Ludwig Beck, who had been retired for about 6 years, would be the nominal new head of state. And the new chancellor, they foresaw, would be a man named Karl Gerdeler, who was a former mayor of the city of Leipzig. In the aftermath of the bomb explosion at the Wolf's Lair headquarters in East Prussia, there was at first tremendous confusion. Nobody knew at first who had planted the bomb. Some suspected that it may have been planted by some foreign workers who were working on the Wolf's Lair headquarters. But very quickly, attention focused on von Stauffenberg, who had made himself conspicuous by the quick way he had left just before the bomb went off and had left and had bluffed his way out of the outer security periphery of the headquarters to get to an airfield to return to Berlin. So immediately, or very quickly, suspicion focused on von Stauffenberg and the officer, an aide with him, when they left the headquarters. But it took several hours for von Stauffenberg to return to Berlin by airplane and then to get from the airport outside of Berlin into the center of the city to the so-called Bendler Block or Bendlerstrasse headquarters of the Reserve Army or Replacement Army, which was the center of the conspiracy to take over the government. It was there in Berlin that the real drama played itself out in over the next several hours as the conspirators tried to make their plan work to take over control of the government. The character, one of the figures that played a major role, a decisive role, in bringing down the conspiracy was a young 31-year-old officer named Otto Ernst Raymer. He was head of the Watch Battalion, the Grossdeutschland Regiment in Berlin, which was under the command of the city commandant, General von Hase. But Otto Rehmer was an extraordinary man, of whom I'm going to speak about in much more detail, who had been made head of the Grossdeutschland Guard Regiment after having served with distinction in Poland, the Balkans, and in the campaign against the Soviet Union. Rehmer had been wounded 8 times, and his courage and his ability had earned him the German Cross in gold, the Iron Cross, and other decorations. So just a few weeks before, he had been made commander of the Guard Regiment in Berlin. Now, Rehmer played a key role in putting down this attempt by von Stauffenberg and the others to gain control of the government. On that day, one of the conspirators, the General von Hase, ordered Rehmer and his troops to seal off and take control of the government buildings in central Berlin and to arrest Reich Minister Dr. Goebbels, who was the most high-ranking national official in Berlin at the time. However, at a dramatic meeting in the minister's office, Goebbels put Rehmer in direct telephone contact with Hitler, who then ordered the major to arrest the conspirators in the German capital and put down the attempted coup. Rehmer did this quickly and with no loss of life. He was immediately promoted by Hitler to colonel, and later Rehmer took part in the December 1944 Ardennes Offensive, the so-called Battle of the Bulge. He was promoted to general in January 1945, and in the final weeks of the war, he commanded a panzer division in Pomerania. Rehmer's loyalty to Hitler and his devotion to National Socialism did not end at the end of World War II. He remained loyal to these convictions in the years afterwards and was active in political work and in other things. And a high point for me Rehmer was his visit to California in 1987 to address a conference of the Institute for Historical Review. At this conference, Rehmer described his role in Berlin on that fateful July 20th of 1944 in a spirited address, and I had the honor of translating simultaneously his remarks in German into English for that meeting. Rehmer's talk at the IHR meeting is available from the IHR in recording, but the what he had to say on that occasion closely follows a chapter of a book he wrote about his experiences, which is also available on the IHR website, in which I translated from German into English. It's entitled My Role in Berlin on July 20th, 1944. And I'm going to read from this because it's a fast-paced look at the dramatic developments in Berlin on that day. He writes, "My assignment to the Guard Regiment Grossdeutschland was actually a form of rest and recreation, in a sense, my first leave from the front after my many wounds and in recognition of my combat decorations, including the Knight's Cross of oak leaves and the close combat badge in silver," which means that it honored him for 48 days of close combat. "Later," Rehmer noted, "I would be wounded again. In all, I was to command the Guard Regiment for only 4 months, since I felt obliged to be back with my comrades at the front. My mission as commander of the Guard Regiment Grossdeutschland, which I took over at the end of May 1944, was, aside from purely ceremonial duties, to safeguard the Reich government and the Reich capital. Since there were more than 1 million foreign workers in Berlin and its immediate vicinity, the possibility of internal unrest had to be taken into account." During the early afternoon of July 20th, 1944, my regiment, like all units of the replacement army, were alerted by the code word Valkyrie. Valkyrie provided for the mobilization of the replacement army in case of internal unrest. While my regiment automatically implemented the prescribed measures, I was summoned from the swimming pool. By the way, this scene of him swimming is also depicted in the movie Valkyrie, although there's a lot of very odd and even stupid embellishments in the movie, but I'll get back to that a bit later. In compliance with my orders, I drove immediately to my designated post, the Berlin City Command Center, directly across from the Eternal Watch Honor Guard. While the other unit commanders waited in the anteroom, I alone was admitted to the city commander, Major General von Haase, and given the following briefing on the situation and my assignment. Von Haase said to Raymer, "The Führer has had a fatal accident. Civil disorder has broken out. The army has assumed executive authority. The Guard Regiment is ordered to concentrate a strong force, reinforced for counterattack, to seal off the government quarter so that nobody, not even a general or a government minister, can enter or leave. To support you in sealing off the streets and subways, I'm seconding Lieutenant Colonel Walters to your command." Well, Raymer explains that he was shocked by this, and he didn't really understand the situation. He didn't know if Hitler had died in an accident, as von Haase had claimed, or he had been assassinated, but he followed his orders because von Haase was his commanding officer. Now, General von Haase was part of the conspiracy, and he was deliberately deceiving Raymer and using him so that he and the other conspirators could seize control in Berlin. Raymer goes on that when he returned to his troops, "I gathered my officers and informed them of the situation and our orders. The alleged death of Adolf Hitler sent officers and men into shock. Never in my life, even in Germany's final defeat," Raymer says, "have I witnessed such despondency. Despite the numerous stories which flourish today, that is the absolute truth. I vouch for it." Raymer also explained in his talk at the IHR conference and also in his book that he had doubts about the description of the situation that he had gotten from General von Haase. And he doubted also that not really, merely because the situation was so unclearly laid out to him, there were also rumors circulated by the conspirators that Hitler had been murdered by the SS. But all this was very vague. Well, but in accordance with his orders, because he didn't understand the complete situation, Raymer and his unit sealed off the government center section of Berlin in accordance with his orders, keeping people from entering or leaving. But the situation remained very unclear as to actually what had happened. Again, at this point, Raymer wasn't sure just who to trust or who not to trust. And a officer who was associated with him, named von Hagen, urged Raymer to look more closely into the situation and made a contact with Dr. Goebbels, who was the Gauleiter or party leader in Berlin, and also, of course, the propaganda minister at his headquarters in the sealed-off area. Now, it's important to remember that during this time, as the conspirators were trying to send out orders saying that command and power had come into their hands, the telephone communication and teletype communication system was still in the hands of Goebbels, of Hitler, and others. And so the situation in Germany for officers around the country and in fact across Europe was very, very unclear. Raymer didn't understand and know who to trust, but he arranged to go to meet with Goebbels, especially in accordance with the orders by his commanding officer to arrest the minister. And Raymer explains that he didn't entirely trust Goebbels, for I still assumed at that point, and again, this is about 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, that Hitler was dead, and I believed that a struggle for secession was possible. I was far from wanting to let myself and my unit be thrust into a struggle, a pitched battle. Inasmuch as Goebbels' role remained unclear, I took along Lieutenant Buck and a platoon of soldiers. Their orders were to come and get me if I didn't emerge from Goebbels' residence in 15 minutes. And then, after releasing the safety catch of my pistol, I entered the office of Minister Goebbels, where I had been awaited, and I asked Goebbels to orient me and describe the situation. At that point, Goebbels asked me to tell him everything I knew. I did so, although I didn't reveal that von Hase intended to arrest him, since I was still unclear as to Goebbels' role in all of this. When Dr. Goebbels asked me what I intended to do, I told him that I would stick to my military orders and that I was determined to carry them out. Even if the Führer were no longer alive, I felt bound by my oath and could only act in accord with my conscience as an officer. At this point, Goebbels looked at me in amazement and cried, "What are you talking about? The Führer is alive. I've spoken with him by telephone. The assassination failed. You've been tricked." This information, Raymer relates, came as a complete surprise. When I heard that the Führer was still alive, I was greatly relieved, but I was still suspicious. Therefore, I asked Goebbels to assure me on his word of honor that what he said was true and that he stood unconditionally behind the Führer. Goebbels hesitated at first because he didn't understand the reason for my request. It was only after I repeated that, as an officer, I needed his word of honor in order to see my way clear, that he obliged. My wish to telephone the Führer's headquarters coincided with his. Within seconds, I was connected to the Wolf's lair at Rostenburg in East Prussia. To my great surprise, Hitler himself came on the line. Goebbels quickly explained the situation to the Führer and then handed me the receiver. Adolf Hitler said to me approximately the following: "Major Raymer, can you hear me? Do you recognize my voice? Do you understand me?" I replied affirmatively, but I was nevertheless uncertain. It flashed through my mind that someone could possibly be imitating the Führer's voice. To be sure, I had become personally acquainted with the Führer's voice during the previous year when, after he awarded me the oak's leaf to the Knight's Cross, I had been able to speak with him alone and completely frankly for an hour about the cares and miseries of the front. It was only as he continued speaking over the telephone that I became convinced that I was indeed speaking with Hitler. He went on to tell me, "As you can tell, I'm alive. The assassination has failed. Providence didn't intend it. A small clique of ambitious, disloyal, and traitorous officers wanted to kill me. Now we've got these saboteurs of the front. We'll make short work of this treacherous plague, by brute force if necessary. From this moment on, Major Raymer, I'm giving you complete authority in Berlin. You are responsible to me personally and exclusively for the immediate restoration of peace and security in the Reich capital. You will remain under my personal command for this purpose until Reichsführer Himmler arrives there and relieves you of responsibility." Raymer relates that the Führer's words, he said, were very calm, determined, and convincing. I could breathe a sigh of relief, for the conversation had removed all my doubts. Now, reassured that Hitler was in fact alive, that Goebbels was still loyal to Hitler, Raymer and his regiment acted very quickly now to put down the conspiracy and seize control, surround the Bendlerstrasse headquarters of the conspiracy, where von Stauffenberg and others were carrying out their operation. Well, one of the great internal weaknesses of the entire conspiracy was that it was based on two fatal glaring flaws. And this is pointed out in a book on the entire operation called Countdown to Valkyrie, written by the British historian Nigel Jones. Nigel Jones points out that the entire Valkyrie plan depended on two things. First, it depended on a successful assassination of Hitler. And second, the whole gigantic edifice of the putsch, Nigel Jones writes, would be built upon a lie. The plotters' proclamation skated skillfully over the central contradiction at the core of their plan. It pretended that the putsch emanated from the Nazis themselves. It described the coup or putsch as being carried out by, quote, a treacherous group of party leaders, rather than by the anti-Hitler conspirators themselves. Therefore, as Jones points out, those troops called upon to suppress the revolt would be mostly loyal to the regime, and unbeknownst to them, would be acting against their own side. How they would react when they realized the deception that had been practiced on them was a question that the conspirators did not address. Well, we'll take a break at this point and resume in a few moments with the second half of this broadcast. A striking feature of the entire plot against Hitler by these conspirators was how poorly organized the entire undertaking really was. In his book, Countdown to Valkyrie, Nigel Jones writes, "There was an air of laxness at the Bender Block that typified the haphazard, almost half-hearted nature of the operation. At that stage," this is at about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, "resolute action might still have saved the day, but confusion, timidity, and irresolution ruled in the offices and corridors where the seconds were ticking away and control of events was slipping irresistibly away from the conspirators." It was at about this time that von Stauffenberg sent out by teletype an order to military units across Germany and to German units in foreign countries, announcing that command of the armed forces was being taken over by, in the name of former General Erwin von Witzleben. The order that was sent out by von Stauffenberg and signed by von Witzleben, although he himself had not personally authorized it, started with the words, "The Führer Adolf Hitler is dead," an unscrupulous clique of non-combatant party leaders has exploited the situation to stab the hard-pressed armies in the back and seize power for their own selfish purposes. In this hour of supreme danger, the Reich government has declared martial law to preserve law and order and appointed me supreme commander of the Wehrmacht, that is, of the armed forces, with absolute executive authority. Well, at this point, the situation, even though the conspirators have set out this command by teletype to military units across the country, announcing that Hitler was dead and that a coup by party leaders, on other occasions they claimed the SS or the Gestapo was behind the attempt to, behind the supposed killing of Hitler, this command sent out was already being countermanded by orders being sent out from Hitler's headquarters in East Prussia, where the switchboard was busy sending out messages assuring everyone that the Führer was in fact alive and that Himmler had been appointed to command the reserve army. It was at this point that another very fatal weakness of the entire conspiracy became obvious. In this period, when it was not clear to many people whether Hitler was really alive or not, or who to support, or which side to believe, it's remarkable that not a single military commander who was not already in on the conspiracy came to support the conspiracy and the effort undertaken by von Stauffenberg, von Witzleben, Gerdeler, and Beck. Not a single liaison officer had appeared to as arranged. The astonishing lack of planning of the entire conspiracy became more and more obvious. No efforts were made to take control of communications so that telephone lines were still being used by Goebbels, by Hitler at his headquarters, and by other officers who were loyal to him. And one of the most important installations in Berlin was not utilized by the conspirators. That was the central radio station, the main radio broadcasting center in Berlin. There was a unit there to take control of it. In fact, one of the members of the conspiracy was in the broadcasting station, but no message was ever given to the conspirator in the broadcasting center to put out their version of events over the radio, which would have at least sown a great deal of confusion in the minds of much of the public and many of people in the military. Now, as the situation continued to deteriorate because Hitler's headquarters was able to countermand the orders being sent out by the conspirators, General von Witzleben himself, who was designated by the conspirators as the new commander-in-chief of the Wehrmacht, at last arrived in the early evening at the Bendlerstrasse headquarters in uniform. He had come from an army base in Sachsen, where he had expected to find a disciplined force ready to seize the state. Well, in fact, it's already amazing that even though the bomb had gone off at 12:42 in the afternoon, and that von Stauffenberg had been working feverishly in the headquarters since about 4 o'clock in the afternoon in Berlin, the man who was designated as the new commander-in-chief didn't show up until several hours after that. When he came in, he, instead of finding a force really that had seized control or was about to seize control, he found only confusion and irresolution. If the plotters of von Stauffenberg and so forth were expecting some infusion of enthusiasm or support from Witzleben, they were very disappointed, because Witzleben was enraged. He was demanding answers to very obvious questions. Where were units ready to be used by the conspiracy? Why had the broadcasting station not been seized? What was going on in the rest of the country? Well, von Stauffenberg and the others with him in the headquarters were unable to give any really clear answers to Witzleben, who was disgusted by the lack of planning and the disorganization and confusion that he found there. And so what he did was simply say, after about half an hour of grumbling and complaining and questioning without any severe real answers, he announced that he was going home. He got in his car and simply drove home. In other words, the conspiracy headquarters was deserted by the very man who was supposed to be the new commander-in-chief after taking power. This is also astonishing for another reason, because von Witzleben should have known or expected, of course, that after all of this, it would be only a matter of time before the conspiracy would collapse completely and people would be coming to his residence to arrest him. Meanwhile, back at the Wolfslayer headquarters in East Prussia, which was Hitler's military command headquarters, the situation had been tremendously cleared up in the meantime, even as the situation was still unclear and somewhat chaotic in Berlin itself. It was now very obvious by this time that von Stauffenberg had planted the bomb. At this time also, as scheduled, Mussolini arrived at the headquarters for a visit as planned to meet with Hitler, and communications were now being established between Hitler's headquarters and all of the military units to counteract and neutralize the efforts of the conspirators. And Hitler himself was not only, of course, enraged by all of this, by this attempt on his life, which had also killed one of his colleagues already and had severely, even mortally wounded others, but he was astonished at the cowardice and the stupidity of the entire plot. At one point, he said to colleagues about how cowardly Stauffenberg had been. He said, Hitler said, if he'd at least had the courage to stay there with his briefcase, but no. And on another point, he said to a colleague that, these cowards, that's exactly what they are. If they had had the courage at least to shoot me, to have some respect, but they didn't want to risk their lives. And this brings up another fatal weakness of the entire conspiracy, is the very small amount of real support it had from ordinary Germans or from ordinary German soldiers and officers. Stauffenberg had almost no one else that he could really count on for decisive action during this very critical time. And it is noteworthy, as Hitler said, that if Stauffenberg wanted to make sure that Hitler was dead, he could have done that. But instead, he carried out an action that meant the deaths, the killing of others who were no more guilty of anything than he himself, Stauffenberg, was. In fact, if someone else had planted a bomb in the room a few minutes earlier, it would have killed von Stauffenberg. But Stauffenberg regarded the deaths of others in the room as acceptable collateral damage. By this time, at about 6 o'clock in the evening, Goebbels and Hitler had already arranged for an announcement to be broadcast on German radio, telling the German people and the world that an attempt had been made on Hitler's life, but that Hitler himself had suffered only very light injuries and had been able to resume his work and even meet as planned with Mussolini for the visit that had already been arranged. When this news broadcast went out over the German radio, that was another very fatal blow to the conspiracy, because it was obvious then, increasingly, that the deceit and lie to the world that Hitler was dead was not going to be believed by anybody. Moreover, German radio announced that later that same evening, a speech by Hitler himself would be broadcast to the nation. Now, at Hitler's headquarters, there was no broadcasting facility, but a sound truck had to be brought in from a nearby city to record talks, a speech by Hitler, and also talks by the head of the Navy and the head of the Air Force that were then recorded and then broadcast later that evening. So by this time, of course, by the time that Hitler's broadcast went out over the airwaves to the nation at 1 o'clock in the morning of the 21st, the conspiracy was completely crushed in Berlin itself. In the speech that was broadcast about an hour after midnight that night, Hitler's voice was heard over German radio. And in this speech, he said, "My fellow Germans, if I speak to you today, it is first in order that you should hear my voice and should know that I am unhurt and well, and secondly, that you should know of a crime unparalleled in German history. A very small clique of ambitious, irresponsible, and at the same time senseless and stupid officers had concocted a plot to eliminate me and, with me, the staff of the High Command of the Armed Forces. The bomb planted by Colonel Count Stauffenberg exploded 2 meters to the right of me. It seriously wounded a number of my true and loyal collaborators, one of whom has died. I myself am entirely unhurt, aside from some very minor scratches, bruises, and burns. I regard this as a confirmation of the task imposed upon me by Providence." Now, it's worth contrasting the public statements made by Hitler in this speech, on the one hand, with the statement made by the conspirators. The statement by Hitler was essentially a truthful one. It was a small clique of officers who were acting in a treacherous way, in a criminal way, to kill him and others in the high command. But the statement by the conspirators was a complete lie. Their statement that the Hitler had been killed, or an attempt had been made on his life, an attempt to kill him, was being made by people within the party itself, and that the conspiracy was taking over in order to defend Germany against those people, was a complete perversion of the facts and of the truth. But far more serious than the deceit that was involved in the conspiracy is the severely wrong misreading of two important realities. First of all, the conspirators completely misread the mood in Germany among the German people at that time, and second, they completely misread the attitude of the Allied governments with whom they hoped, after taking power, to negotiate some sort of peace settlement so that the war would not result in a complete catastrophe and loss. With regard to the first miscalculation or misunderstanding of the reality, one German historian who has written a book about the July 20th conspiracy notes how, in his view, how depressing it is that even if von Stauffenberg had blown Hitler, had killed Hitler, the coup would not have succeeded. He points out that the army overwhelmingly showed no inclination whatsoever to join the rebels, and not a single officer spontaneously joined the uprising or the conspiracy on July 20th, even though, for much of that day, it was widely believed that Hitler was dead. In the aftermath of the July 20th attempt on Hitler's life, there was an enormous outpouring of messages, of public statements by people, not just of an official capacity, but by ordinary people giving thanks and gratitude that Hitler had not been killed. In fact, many people have taken the view that the conspiracy and von Stauffenberg's place in history would have been is better if Hitler had lived than if he had died, because if he had died, some people have said, Hitler would have been regarded as a martyr, which was not, of course, the case as it happened, because Hitler survived the bomb attempt. But perhaps a more severe miscalculation by the conspirators was in misreading completely the attitude and intention of the Allied governments at that time. The conspirators believed that if they seized control, they could then sit down with the British, Americans, and maybe the Soviets to negotiate some sort of end to the war that would not result in the complete occupation and destruction of Germany, and, as they especially feared, the takeover of much of Germany by the Soviet Union, by Stalin's troops. But this was a complete misreading of the situation, and a reality that Hitler himself very well understood. The Allies were not interested in ending the war. They were interested, and not interested merely in crushing the Hitler government. They were interested in crushing Germany as a totality. As one historian has pointed out, the Allies appeared to have concluded that it was the entire German nation that had put Hitler in power and followed him into war, and it was the entire German nation that would have to be taught a lesson it would never forget. In London, Prime Minister Churchill spoke briefly about the attempt on Hitler's life and merely said that the highest personalities in the German Reich were trying to kill each other off. More astonishing than that, the BBC radio, the British broadcasting, began putting out, not only dismissing the plot, but by broadcasting the names that they knew of people who were involved in the conspiracy, whose identities at this point were still not known to the German police and the German authorities. In fact, so astonishing was this that one German historian said that the BBC, in fact, by doing this, did a big favor to Hitler by revealing the identities that were unknown of some of those who were involved in the conspiracy. One of those who was involved in the plot was a man named Eugen Gerstenmayer, who later became president of the German parliament after the war. And later he acknowledged, quote, "What we in the German resistance didn't really want to grasp, we've subsequently learned completely. The war really wasn't waged against Hitler, but against Germany." If the Allies were really interested in just ending the war, that could have been done at any time along the time of the entire conflict. Already in 1939, after the first of all, it was the British and French that declared war against Germany in September 1939, after the German attack against Poland, a local conflict between those two countries over some very specific issues. But then, after the end of the Polish campaign, the efforts by Germany to end the war were brusquely turned down by Britain. Then, even after the fall of France in July 1940, the British rejected any efforts towards ending the conflict at that time on a basis that would have been meant that no violation of British interests or of British honor. And then already by 1944, the Allied governments had publicly proclaimed that the only acceptable basis for ending the war was unconditional surrender. The proof that the Allied governments would not negotiate with any new government, even if it was headed by von Stauffenberg and so forth, is shown by the fact that shown by the way in which the Allied powers treated the government headed by Admiral Dönitz after Hitler's death. After Hitler died, the government authority was held by Grand Admiral Dönitz as the new Reich president. But 3 weeks after the end of the war, he was simply arrested by the Allied authorities in a humiliating way, completely illegal, by the way, and then put on trial for so-called war crimes. And this shows that for the Allied governments, for the Allied powers, this was not a conflict against Hitler or against even the National Socialist State. It was a war waged against Germany, which resulted in Germany's complete subjugation by the victorious Allies. Another important aspect of all of this is that the men of the July 20th conspiracy, by today's standards, would be considered Nazis. None of them were in favor of democracy in the Western sense today. Men like von Stauffenberg, in fact, supported the Hitler government up until into the war years of 1941, 42, 43. Von Stauffenberg supported the measures to remove Jews from political and cultural life in Germany, for example. He didn't have any argument about that. He didn't believe in equality or democracy in the Western sense. And by today's standards, the views of von Stauffenberg, Gerdeler, Witzleben, and so forth would be considered so-called Nazi-like in their attitude and their values. Another irony of the entire plot, of the entire conspiracy, is that von Stauffenberg was not put to death by, quote, the Nazis. What happened in the evening of July 20th is that when it became clear that the coup, the putsch, was not going to work, von Stauffenberg was arrested by his own commander, General Fromm, who then, to cover up his own involvement with the conspiracy, took von Stauffenberg and three other officers down into the courtyard of the headquarters, and there, under the light of headlights from trucks, had a firing squad shoot von Stauffenberg and three other officers. Now, this wasn't done because Fromm was some evil Nazi who was extracting vengeance against von Stauffenberg. He did it to try to save his own skin. Well, it didn't work. General Fromm's own involvement was eventually uncovered, and he was eventually executed himself for his own role or participation or sanction of the conspiracy. Finally, it's well worth remembering that the entire ethics of killing a commander because one thinks that his policies might lead to military defeat, or because one thinks that he knows better than the commander what to do in a situation, is an extremely dangerous principle to condone. More than one writer has made the point that if officers should carry out killings of their commanders if they do things that are illegal or result in loss of life, the point could be made that President George Bush or President Obama or other military American presidents could and should be, on that basis then, killed by members of the military for getting the United States involved in wars that result in death and destruction on the basis of lies and deceit and against the Constitution and international law. Well, that concludes this broadcast. I hope you'll join me for the next Mark Weber Report.